Finance Division to order for January 16th. Today's first order of business is going to be continuing our DHS-based budget overview by program area. A couple of announcements. First off, we're going to change the order of the presentations a little bit, and the healthcare administration is going to go first after I get through a couple of items. I know we're shy of members, but we do have at least a bipartisan group here. Nearly half, and I think people will be trickling in. There was a little bit of snow and a little bit of traffic this morning, so hopefully people will come. Senator Brown was kind enough to mention that there may be a little bit of confusion. The notice that went out did say that we would be meeting in room 123, but yesterday we met in room 107. The reason for this, and to try to give people a little bit of understanding of where we're going, is traditionally this room is the Finance Committee's room, and Finance is scheduled for the same time slot as Health and Human Services is, but Finance very rarely meets during this early part of the session. This is a better room to be meeting in and to accommodate the crowds that HHS often attracts, and so when Finance is not meeting, we will be over here. But when there arises a conflict a little bit later on in the session, once Finance starts meeting more regularly, we will be bumped on occasion, and we will we put on the calendar room 107 to make sure that we didn't find ourselves homeless, that we had a place to go and meet when there are concurrent hearings between Finance and HHS. So there is a little bit of confusion, but the notice was correct that room 123 is where we were meeting today. Sorry if anybody missed that because of the fact that we met in 107 yesterday. There was supposed to be a Finance Committee hearing here yesterday. There was not. It occurred very quickly down in 15. But just work with us, and any confusion, check between 107 and 123. If we're calling a meeting, we will be in one of the two locations. If anybody has any questions or if that didn't make sense, you know, do feel free to ask now publicly, and I'll try to clarify it as best I can. Seeing none, I'll just go ahead and ask Scott Leitz, Assistant Commissioner for the Healthcare Administration, to the table and step us through. And that is the first handout in people's packet.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Scott Leitz. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at the Department of Human Services. I'm going to walk you through the Healthcare Administration's budget overview of the programs that we administer and the budget that's associated with them. On the first slide in, titled Healthcare Administration, I just want to give you a sense of who we are and the work that we do. The Healthcare Administration oversees the state's public health insurance programs, which includes Minnesota Care and our state's Medicaid program. And we do that in a number of ways. We determine and administer the eligibility determinations and oversee that aspect for the two programs. We administer and determine the benefits. We also, associated with that, determine payment rates for both our fee-for-service programs, the programs that we directly pay for out of the agency, as well as the managed care contracting that we do for a large majority of our enrollees. We do contracting and purchasing for healthcare services, and we also provide enrollee and provider customer service. We obviously have many, many individuals who are enrolled in public programs. We operate a public customer service area that helps them when they have problems getting services. And we also enroll a lot of providers into our Medicaid program as providers. And so we have systems set up to provide service to them should they have trouble getting enrolled or have trouble with payments that we administer. We have a claims processing system that where providers, when they provide services to our enrollees, submit claims, and we make payments out of that system. And then we measure and evaluate how well our programs are doing in serving the clients that we have, both from a cost, but also importantly, a quality perspective. So we really cover the general aspects of the administration of the programs of Medicaid and Minnesota Care. The next slide, at a very high level, describes the public health care programs that we administer. The first is medical assistance, which is Minnesota's Medicaid program. which enrolls approximately 768,000 individuals in Minnesota. The Minnesota Care Program, which is a state-subsidized program that was established back in 1992 to provide health insurance coverage for people who otherwise wouldn't have it, and it with because they had incomes above the Medicaid level, enrolls about 127,000 people. And then we are supplement to Medicare, meaning the Medicaid program serves as a supplement to the Medicare program for elderly Minnesotans who are very low income and need assistance with cost sharing that the Medicare program has. Those are called the dually eligible. You'll hear that term a fair amount. We operate our programs in collaboration with the federal government. Federal government oversees and establishes general rules for the Medicaid program, and then states operate their Medicaid programs underneath those rules with some flexibility. As a result of that, we split the costs of the program with the federal government, and we have what's often called federal financial participation, or you'll hear the term FFP. And that means that the cost of the program is split between Minnesota and the federal government. And generally in Minnesota, our match rate, or our FFP, is 50%, means we pay half of the cost of the program, and the federal government pays half the cost. I'll next move more specifically to talk a little bit about Medicaid and the programs there, as well as the base budgets for those programs.
1 minute, Mr. Leitz. Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Leitz, thank you very much. We discussed a little last night, thanks to Senator Kiffmeyer, that our match is different than other states. Could you give us an example? I think it helps put in context, maybe for people who haven't been here before, sure, how the federal government punishes people doing the right thing, basically, and gives benefit to those states who aren't working hard on health reform.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, there's a couple separate issues there. The first is that the match rate that the federal government provides to state Medicaid programs varies depending on the per capita income in the state. So wealthier states receive a somewhat lower match rate, and states that are poorer have a lower per capita income have higher match rates. So, for example, Minnesota, the lowest you can ever receive is 50%, and Minnesota's at that level because we have, on average, a pretty high per capita income. A state like Louisiana, for example, which has a very low per capita income, I think receives a matching rate close to 80%. And so that really varies based on income. And I think the questions that Senator Kiffmeyer asked last night and you're raising again today really relates to some of the payment systems that have been put in place, particularly through the Medicare program, that are based on historic spending trends. And what happened over time is that as Minnesota built a really efficient healthcare system, and again, much of the upper Midwest did this as well, our friends in the Dakotas and Wisconsin as well, the payment rates that Medicare established were based on sort of national trend spending. And so the states that did a lot of spending and weren't as efficient, Florida, New York, Texas, ended up with somewhat higher payment rates. States that did very well ended up with somewhat lower payment rates. That's primarily done was part of the Medicare program. One of the aspects of the Medicaid program is that the federal government establishes broad rules, and then states have responsibility for really establishing payment rates for our own Medicaid program. So we do have a little bit of flexibility related to that in the Medicaid program that isn't as clear in the Medicare program.
Senator Lurie.
Senator Sharon.
I'll just take the opportunity. I talked with Mr. Leitz last night about this as well, related to what Senator Benson is asking. We also set rates for the Medicaid program in the state of Minnesota for hospitals. And in one concern that I've had the entire time I've been in the legislature is the fact that we have not rebased those rates since the beginning of time. And if it's established based on costs, if the base rate was established based on cost, then we get back within the state into the same dynamic that you're talking about at the federal level, which is that if you have places that have created efficiencies and reduced their costs, then they become harmed if you base the rate on costs. And they're then, on the rebasing, penalized for those efficiencies. So I'm hoping that as a part of all of this discussion, we're looking at how we've established rates for hospitals and what we need to do in the area of rebasing and whether or not we have a blend of costs, which is the actual cost of doing business and the book of business, you know, the balance of Medicare, Medicaid, and self-pay persons in our hospital systems. There's huge variations, And at some point, I think everybody should have a look at what the differentials are for hospital payment rates.
Assistant Commissioner Lights.
Mr. Chair, the Medicaid, I'm on a slide which says, what is Medicaid? Medicaid is a public insurance program that it's for families and individuals with low incomes. And as I mentioned, it's jointly funded and regulated by the state as well as the federal government. And the federal government establishes, as we just discussed, the federal Medicaid medical assistance percentage, or the FMAP percentage, which is the amount that the state receives as matching funds to operate the program. And again, our regular matching rate is 50%. Federal law does require that state Medicaid programs cover certain categories of individuals and services, disabled individuals, for example. But beyond that, states have some flexibility in how they design and implement their Medicaid programs. Just so you know, we call Medicaid in Minnesota medical assistance. That's a statutory term for it here. And then I'll talk very briefly in a couple minutes just about the Minnesota Care program. Minnesota Care is also considered to be part of the Medicaid program because it's operated under what's called a federal waiver, or a federal Section 1115 waiver, and allows us to waive certain rules of the Medicaid program and still receive federal participation from a financial perspective. And in the case of Minnesota Care, we required that individuals on Minnesota Care waive premiums, and so we had to seek a waiver to be able to receive matching funds on that program. The next slide shows that Medicaid is funded through a combination of state payments from the general fund as well as the federal financial participation we receive. And we've listed out the populations where we receive joint federal and state funding for the Medicaid program. It's kids up to 100, under 18 up to 150 of poverty, kids 19 to 20 up to 100% of poverty, rather, pregnant women up to 275% of poverty, and then parents and persons who are 65 or older, blind or disabled, up to the poverty level. And then effective March of 2011, we started enrolling adults without children below 75% of poverty in the medical assistance program. In terms of spending, which is the next slide, which is a chart of enrollment and cost projections for fiscal year 2014, we break this into three major categories of eligibility. The first is families with children. This would include parents. This would include the kids associated with that. About 489,000 people are enrolled in this category, with total costs of about $2.3 billion estimated for 2014. That's both federal and state dollars, with a per capita spend of about $47.53 per person. We enroll about a little less than 200,000 elderly and disabled individuals, but you can see that their spending, while only being about a third as large a group, is about the same as it is for families with kids. That means the per capita spending on these individuals is over $12,000. Again, that's not surprising. These are individuals who, by definition, are disabled, have high health needs, and so therefore the cost associated with them is somewhat larger. And adults without children, the group that we started enrolling in March, enrolls about 93,000 people with a total spending of about $1 billion. Again, their per capita spending, because these are very low-income individuals, oftentimes with multiple chronic health conditions, oftentimes with coexisting mental health conditions, is relatively high compared to our families and children's groups. So all told, for the medical assistance program, we enroll about 768,000 people. Spending on that program is about $5.7 billion estimated for fiscal 2014, both federal and state funds. I should mention these cost figures include most of the healthcare-related services, but not long-term care or waivered services. The next slide just makes the point I think I was making earlier. If you look at share of enrollment versus share of payment, you see that, you know, while families and kids are the majority of our enrollment, about 70, almost three quarters of it, it's only about 30% of our total spending. Kids are pretty cheap in general. But when you get into groups like the elderly and the disabled, they do have a smaller share of enrollment, but a much larger proportion of our expenditures. And again, that's because of the disproportionate health status that they have.
I think you're missing.
And similar with adults without children. The next slide just shows trend over the last 10 years of spending. You do see an increase for projections for 2013 and 2014. That's really due to a couple of factors. One is that there will be the requirement that people have health insurance coverage starting in 2014, which causes spending to go up because we'll have more people coming on to the program. So this is aggregate spending, not per capita spending. And the second is that we there were some payment delays that occurred as a result of legislative action in fiscal year 2011 that will essentially cause payments to be delayed and then move into fiscal 14 instead of fiscal 13 as a way to provide savings for the last biennium. So those payments will show up on this biennium, which causes a little bit of a jump. So this is for elderly and disabled basic care. You see a similar trend on the next slide for families with children in basic care. Again, growth into the future due to the requirement of health insurance coverage and the payment delays as well. We don't have a slide for adults without kids due to some limited enrollment history on them.
Senator Sharon.
Would you talk again about, I was reading, would you explain again why we're seeing, you know, people are going to talk about the increased cost of this program. Would you articulate clearly for me again what the reason is for that bump related to what we did budgetarily last time?
Sure. Senator Sharon, Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I articulated a couple of reasons. The first was really related to the requirement that individuals have health insurance coverage. And what our reports and forecasts people have estimated is that will cause more people, because of that requirement, to come into our programs. The people who maybe were previously eligible but not enrolled who will now come in because they have a requirement to have insurance coverage. The second was really related to a budgetary action that was taken by the 2011 legislature to delay payments that would have otherwise occurred during fiscal 12 or 13 and move those into fiscal 14. And those were really related to kind of as we were trying to figure out how to solve the budgetary problem, we simply moved a payment that otherwise would have occurred during this time period into the next time period to kind of get it off that biennium's books, if you will.
Just a follow up. If I may have
Senator Sharon.
So in that shift, does that – it just will create a budgetary problem for us to resolve this time?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, it does show up as an expenditure in that fiscal period, the next fiscal period.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the next area is Minnesota Care, and that's a health care program, again, for individuals who do not have access to either employer-based coverage – or have incomes that are above the Medicaid eligibility levels. These are typically working individuals and families. This is a program established about 20 years ago to do this work. The main distinction between Medicaid and Minnesota Care is that folks on Minnesota Care have somewhat higher incomes than the folks on Medicaid, and they pay a premium every month. And so it's a premium-based program on a sliding scale. It was created in 1992. And we operate this program under a Section 1115 waiver. This is, again, this federal waiver that allows us to operate a program that has premiums but also receive federal funding for that program. We received that waiver in 1995, and that has allowed us over the course of the last 17 years or so to operate the program with federal match. On the next slide, it indicates how Minnesota Care is funded. We fund the program through state payments from the Healthcare Access Fund. The Healthcare Access Fund was established in 1992, and there's a provider, what's called a provider tax at the level of 2% that's placed on the gross revenues of all providers in the state. That money goes into the Healthcare Access Fund to pay for the Minnesota Care program. There's also a 1% premium tax, which is placed on HMOs and nonprofit health corporations, and funding also from that tax goes into the Healthcare Access Fund to pay for the program. Enrollee premiums also go into the Healthcare Access Fund, as well as federal funding that we receive for the program. So it's kind of paid for from a number of sources. People who are enrolled in Minnesota Care, the eligibility levels for folks, kids under 21, it's up to 275% of poverty. Pregnant women also up to 275. Parents up to 275 of poverty, and then adults without children are eligible for the regular Minnesota Care program up to 200% of poverty. And we receive federal match on all those populations. There are a number of other populations that we've listed here who are enrolled technically in Minnesota Care or paid for out of the Healthcare Access Fund that are state funded, and that would include adults who are enrolled in the Healthy Contribution Program. This is a program that provides subsidies to individuals to purchase private coverage. Lawfully present non-citizens who don't qualify for federal funding due to their immigration status, and then legal guardians and foster parents. The next slide breaks down the, again, by those.
One second. Senator Hayden.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Lynch. So you're saying that the Healthy Contribution Program does not get a federal match?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
The next slide we have simply breaks down the enrollment and costs associated with the program for the two major categories, families with kids and adults without children. We enroll total about 127,000 people in the Minnesota CARE program. About three-quarters of those are families with kids, about a quarter adults without children, at a total program cost for 2014 of around $645 million. And I should just mention parenthetically that the figures here don't include the healthy contribution folks aren't included in these numbers. It's just mainly the regular program numbers. The next slide has the sort of growth trend for the program or what it's looked like over the course of the last 10 years. I'll just note that there's one notable dip that occurs right around 2011, fiscal year 2012, and that's due to the implementation of the early expansion of the Medicaid population. What we did under federal law was expand Medicaid, as I mentioned earlier, in March of 2011. That brought a lot of people who otherwise would have been eligible for Minnesota CARE out of the program and into the Medicaid program. And so you see a dip that occurs in that time period. We'll see it go back up again once the mandate is put in place and you have folks coming back into the program in 2014.
When you take that out of the Minnesota CARE costs, though, when they went in to Medicaid, it's at a 50% rate, right? And the 50% that we still pay is still in those costs.
Mr. Chair, correct? Yes, that okay. is correct. They stayed
even
at the
though
same
it's a
match rate.
It's a Medicaid, yeah.
Yeah, it was just paid for out of a separate, different fund, if you will.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, that we have a number of other slides that relate to some of the other aspects of purchasing. I don't know if, in the interest of time, you want me to go through those, or if that covers the major budgetary pieces I wanted to put before the committee.
I think we have time.
Okay. Well, I wanted just to give the committee some information on some of the efforts that we're taking to help to better manage, I think, the program itself and to bring more efficiencies to the Medicaid program. We've been focusing a lot in our work on purchasing reform in a couple of different areas. One is to continue to improve how we procure our managed care contracts for people. The majority of our enrollees in Medicaid do go through managed care plans, all the Minnesota CARE enrollees, as well as the vast majority of our Medicaid enrollees do. We implemented a number of purchasing reforms for fiscal years 12 and 13 when the governor took office, and that included things like doing competitive bidding in the 7-county metro area for our 2012 contracts. That was a very successful process that allowed us to actually lower the cost of our contracts relative to where they were in 2011. We were very proud of that fact, and the plans, I think, aggressively bid on those contracts. And then a voluntary 1% profit cap that Commissioner Jessen negotiated with the health plans for the year 2011. When we combine all those things along with some other reforms that we placed, we estimate that around $600 million in state budgetary savings resulted from those. So we think we're making some good progress around how we're managing the program. We did also, the legislature acted to limit future growth in our managed care rates through some caps that were put in place on capitation growth into the future. And we actually, in our contracts for 2013, did actually reduce the managed care rates even relative to those caps. So I think we even found some additional savings in the budget. So I think we're making some progress there. On the next slide, we also simultaneously launched some new payment demonstrations in Medicaid that started in January of 2013. We talked a little about this last night for those of you who were able to be there. This was what's called our Healthcare Delivery Systems, or HCDS, demonstration projects. And what these are direct contracting arrangements with provider organizations where we work directly with the organizations to negotiate an agreed-upon spending trend for those organizations. We look at the quality outcomes that they have and also compare their actual spending to the negotiated kind of target spending that they have. If they're actually able to come in below that target, they share in some of that savings. Again, it's a way to try to put the incentives in a different place than they previously had been, which was to spend more because you got paid more. In this case, you're actually incented to work with us to get good quality outcomes for folks, but also try to do so in an efficient manner to hold down costs. And so they're accountable for total cost of care for their Medicaid patients. And then, as is mentioned, payment is based on performance, cost, and quality. We have six organizations who are participating in this demo, started in January, started January 1st. About 100,000 of our enrollees are going to seek care at a system that's involved in this demonstration. I think you'll also see that we'll be rolling out another request for proposals to do even more of these later on this month, most likely.
Mr. Lights, Assistant Commissioner Lights, these are really exciting reforms that we want to track carefully through the legislature. I mean, this is really the ability to kind of break down some of the silos that we have and really allow the healthcare system to build those patient-centered teams in an interdisciplinary approach and bring in sort of the whole person into the mix and break down some of those barriers and hook up, link up with social service agencies, county social service agencies, housing, mental health folks, and really try to better understand who the patient is to provide the right care at the right time. And through those, and this was actually largely built off of some of the learnings that we got from the CCDS in when Hennepin County picked that up and broke down some of those barriers and spent those, you know, I mean, CCDS was, you know, a very small percentage of the cost of care for these individuals. But through implementing that, HCMC was really the lion's share of what got done. And when they had that very small spend to make, they really learned how, you know, if people come to your emergency room and they're actually presenting with dental care, it saves money to try to address the dental care rather than giving them an antibiotic and an opiate and sending them back onto the street and letting them return 2 months later for more ER care, that it's a wiser use. So, I mean, breaking down some of those barriers, that's just one critical example. And so I think, and these are typically very bipartisan approaches that make a good deal of sense. So applaud your efforts in that, and the committee be aware that this is a lot of what we'll be trying to track and book the savings around and make sure that we watch carefully. So thank you for that brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could just very briefly, you mentioned Hennepin County. I failed to mention the really great efforts that Hennepin Health is doing. And what Hennepin Health is a program where we're working directly with the county. They're paid a capitation rate just as any managed care organization would be paid to enroll our very lowest income Medicaid recipients, that early expansion group below 75% of poverty. And you're right, Mr. Chair, that was really built off the learnings that the county had during the CCDS times. And what the capitation allows them to do is really move money around within the county so they invest a little bit more on the social service side. And the goal here is to try to create better outcomes for folks, but also savings at the state level as well as the county level, because those low-income folks have a lot of issues that are mental health related. The hope is that we'll get both social service savings, county jail savings potentially, as well as Medicaid savings. So we're tracking that very closely.
And then also, that's just all in the public side. When we do this better, there's general savings to the entire healthcare industry when we succeed in these models. And that needs to be understood too. So thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last thing I'll mention, I'm not going to go through all the slides on the Affordable Care Act implementation, but I really only wanted to bring this before your group right now to mention that we know that this will be an important budgetary issue that we'll be looking at. It's obviously very important from an enrollment perspective as well, we'll really be looking at a number of things that will be coming before the committee, including things that are related to things that we're required to do under the ACA that will bring people who are currently eligible for our programs into those programs, things like 12-month eligibility, presumptive eligibility at determinations at hospitals, eliminating asset tests and other things. Those are all requirements under the Affordable Care Act. We'll be bringing some questions that the legislature will have to look at around the optional expansion of the Medicaid program to 138% of poverty for single adult populations. And then the final issue that you'll obviously will be looking working very closely with you on and that the legislature will have to decide on is what do we do for populations above 138% of poverty who are currently in the Minnesota CARE program. And obviously we've been having a lot of discussions with CMS around that issue. And whether we're able to access basic health plan funding to help continue this program that we've had in Minnesota CARE for the past two decades. So that just wanted to mention that, Mr. Chair, since we know that that'll be a pretty important part of this committee's deliberations.
Absolutely. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Leitz. And you went over a few things last night. And as I mulled them over, the MAGI standards and eliminating the asset test, and if this goes far afield and will be a much protracted discussion, then we'll have it during the budget and exchange discussions. But does the federal government require that then for our other programs? The exchange is going to be serving multiple programs. Will MAGI become the standard for food stamp enrollment and TANF programs? I'm just trying to wrap my head around some of this now.
Mm-hmm. Assistant Commissioner Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, it's actually a really excellent question. I believe the answer is it really applies to the Medicaid program, but I'm going to sort of just say that I think that's the answer, but we'll be looking at that more closely. I do think that one of the things that we are hopeful for moving forward is that the systems, though, that we build to enroll people into our programs, I talked a little bit last night about how antiquated the current systems are and how we're hoping to sort of leverage that IT platform that the exchange is building to make it a little bit more seamless for our folks. We're actually hoping into the future that that will also be a more seamless platform for folks who are applying for non-healthcare things as well, food stamps or other things as well. So I just wanted to mention that because I think that's going to be a key piece moving forward.
Your response meshes with my understanding of what it is, too. We wouldn't be mandated to adopt the MAGI standards. It would be up to the legislature and I think and the administration as we work through it, and we hope to get to a place that streamlines and makes the most sense for enrollees and leverages the systems investments that we're doing. And still makes the best use of our scarce public resources, but it's our option. Still, I believe, how we operate other programs outside of Medicaid. But there is significant systems investment behind the building of the exchange and the bringing on of this eligibility function. And so it would make some sense to look at how we can mesh those and make it easier for enrollees and for people taking the enrollments and for the systems that are accommodating them and figure that out as we go. Senator Benson, you had a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I don't want to get too far afield, but it's my understanding from Commissioner Showalter that integrated online eligibility will be part of the exchange. If not at the front end, it has been architected in. And so this group is going to have to think about those standards depending on when integrated online eligibility is meshed with the exchange. And since we don't see a timeline yet, I just want to get the wheels turning on some of those tough decisions.
Yep. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Leitz, I apologize I wasn't here last night because I had a taste of pork. And one of my and you missed that. It was great, Senator Sharon. It was the pork producers. And I have more pork in my district than anybody. So one of my constituents was being honored. But anyway, I missed the whole thing last night. When do you expect some answers from the Fed on what to do with the basic health plan and what we're going to do? Don't we have to have some decisions on our Minnesota CARE population? And
we do. Commissioner Leitz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, let me just add parenthetically, anyone who knows me knows I'm a huge fan of bacon, so I'm 100% with you on the pork aspect.
It's a big deal.
You're absolutely right. I think there's a lot of obviously urgency to us getting some settled answers one way or another, quite frankly, on the issue of what we're able to what the federal government is able to work with us on around funding for Minnesota CARE. You know, we've indicated to them that clearly by the by February forecast, we have to have some solid we have to know the answers by that time, because you all have to know what your options are as you make some very challenging and difficult decisions moving forward. And I think they have understood that in the meeting that the commissioner and I and Carol Backstrom, our Medicaid director, had with Medicaid director Cindy Mann last Friday. She did indicate that that's something that they believe they can commit to by the end of February, of getting us some answers that are pretty firm by that point. So I think that's kind of what we've committed to, or what they've committed to. That's certainly what we've indicated. We'd obviously love to have answers sooner than that, and I think are going to apply whatever pressure we're able to, including through our congressional delegation and other means. And certainly the communities of stakeholders here in Minnesota has been really great on that. I think they've been reaching out to the White House and to other parts of the federal government to try to move that along, and we're committed to using whatever means we need to kind of keep the pressure on to get an answer to those questions.
And it is Senator Sharon, it is a full court press trying to make sure that the feds understand that Minnesota, you know, has a long tradition of being a healthcare leader in the country, and largely through our bipartisan 20-year history with supporting low-income working Minnesotans and their families in getting the health care coverage that allows them to get the care they need when they need it. And truthfully, the affordability standards under the Affordable Care Act, without some accommodation for this population, would move Minnesota backwards. And these are real people. These are all of our friends and neighbors that are historically served well by this program. And, you know, so we're making a full court press. In fact, I've got a letter I'm hoping to get you to sign on that I'm going to run over to you in just a minute. And we're trying to get, you know, everybody together on this message that the feds really need to work with Minnesota to help us to make sure that our implementation of the Affordable Care Act moves us forward and allows us to continue our leadership role in health care for our people. And just understanding that framework so that we can then have the conversation about how we use whatever we get from the feds to make the right decisions for Minnesota is absolutely critical, and the February forecast is the drop-dead date that we're using. So I'm confident. Senator Franken was here last Friday. He's had talks with the president himself and the commissioner of HHS several times, and we're just really coalescing around this message and trying to make it just a full court press from Minnesota that we need these answers. We need them now so that we can craft our policies and our budgets around whatever is available from the feds.
Good. Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Lurie. I just wanted to have a chance to respond to Senator Rosen's attending the Pork Producers' Taste of Elegance last night and support for pork, because I wanted on the record that this is an acknowledgement with me of a bipartisan support for pork
and
of all sorts, and also that Judy Bodie from my district and Reuben Bodie, who are pork producers, received an award last night as well. I was able to get to their award recognition before the 6 o'clock meeting for the marketing of pork. So it's nice to hear that there's a bipartisan support for pork.
All right, and Commissioner Chair. Lights gave a shout-out to bacon, and I have to say bacon is why I run, too. I run so that I can eat bacon whenever I want, and it works well for me, bacon and ice cream.
And Mr. Chair, as the media will do, they will take this out of context and say that the Capitol has bipartisan support for pork, which is something we've been fighting in Washington for years.
That was my point, Senator Benson.
This is where you're stopping?
This is where I'm stopping, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Commissioner Lights? Seeing none, thank you, Scott, for coming and sharing that. We're taking state-operated services next, I believe. No? Who's next? Chemical and mental health services. We're starting at the bottom of the list that we have before us and working up, apparently, so that the chair knows who's going to be next. Who's going to be after chemical
State
and mental health?
Services.
Okay, so we're working right up.
There was some conflict in the schedule.
All right. We can work with that. So, chemical and mental health, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Dave Hartford, and I am the Acting Assistant Commissioner for Chemical and Mental Health Services. I'll be giving a brief overview of those services. In your packet, there's two handouts, one brief handout with some figures on the back and also a color pie chart around federal federal expenditures. The Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration houses both the Mental Health Authority and the Substance Abuse Authority in the state, with the responsibility for policy and standards development, technical assistance, consultation, and training. Three distinct divisions make up the administration: the Adult Mental Health Division, the Children's Mental Health Division, and the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division. While each one of these divisions have really distinct expertise, provide specific technical expertise, have different funding streams, and have different populations served, we really try to have those three administrations more and more, I think, to the point that some of the points that were just being made, historically, we can make improvements in how these administrations work together. And I think the language more and more in this area is around behavioral health services and how can we better integrate the different components of behavioral health services, chemical and mental health services, and do a better job. And not only with that, but opportunity is there as we work ever more closely with healthcare administration and to better incorporate behavioral health services into primary care, into the rest of medicine, so that our health care is really integrated and we find those opportunities. The administrative funding for chemical and mental health services for the biennium is approximately $8.5 million. CMHS employs approximately 87 staff whose salaries are funded by a combination of both state and federal funds. The Adult Mental Health Division, along with the Children's Mental Health Division, constitute the state mental health authority. As such, the Adult Mental Health Policy Division works closely with counties as the local mental health authority, but also as important is with the 16 regional mental health initiatives as planning groups. We also work with the 11 tribal community authorities, public and private providers, consumers, families, advocates, and other state agencies, and funders to shape, develop, evaluate policy, service delivery, and financing. All of our efforts are really around developing support for a person-centered, recovery-based delivery system. The Minnesota publicly funded mental health system serves approximately 116,000 people annually. This is done through a variety of programs, assertive community treatment, intensive residential treatment services, community crisis teams, so a variety of different kinds of services. The division works to develop new programs of services consistent with research-informed evidence and evidence-based practice. Minnesota continues to be a national leader in the implementation of evidence-based practice. Just this last year, we implemented a certification program for integrated dual diagnosis treatment, the first certification of its kind in the country. And again, back to that theme of having the different areas work more collaboratively, because people don't come with single problems. They often come with multiple problems. Monitor and evaluate the performance of local service delivery systems, typically with the county or region as a unit of analysis. We also develop standards and fiscal policy for services funded through the Minnesota healthcare programs in partnership with the healthcare administration. We partner with other areas of DHS and state departments with roles, responsibilities relevant to the public mental health system. We monitor funding of approximately $150 million of state-appropriated grant funds. And we also allocate and monitor our federal mental health grants. In the area of children's mental health, We are committed to promoting and supporting the mental health development of all Minnesota children and youth. The division is responsible for developing and sustaining a community infrastructure of what's very important, developmentally appropriate services and supports for children and adolescents with mental health challenges and their families. Our vision is that these services will be as fully informed by research as possible and will lead to measurable reduction in mental health symptoms and increases in strengths and functional abilities, such that children who have had challenges during their development can approach and enter adulthood as resilient, competent youth. An estimated 91,000 children in Minnesota need treatment for emotional disturbances. That's approximately 9% of school-age children and 5% of preschool children have some kind of emotional disturbance. We know that early identification intervention produce better lifelong outcomes for these children. That's why the division's priorities are early intervention and early identification intervention, early access to services statewide, and effective services. Currently, approximately 43,000 Minnesota children receive publicly funded mental health services.
The children, 1 second, Mr. Hartford. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Senator and Chairman. Question I have for you, you made a statement about you know about these youth or children, preschool and otherwise, the 9% and so on. Can you tell me the source for that information?
Mr. Hartford.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I do not know the source offhand, but I can certainly get that for you.
Would you please do that? I'd appreciate it.
I'd be
Thank
glad
you.
To do that. The Chemical and Mental Health Division has historically played several key roles in the state's mental health system, including monitoring and providing specific technical assistance to county human services agencies in their role as their local mental health authorities. We administer and monitor in the children's area $35 million of state appropriated grants. We provide clinical expertise for the design, implementation, administration of children's mental health benefits in Minnesota mental health care programs. We also support the 95 local family service and children's mental health collaboratives. These are vehicles for integration of care across local child-serving systems in the state. We also collect and analyze data to determine both individual and system outcomes. An example we recently implemented was the psychotropic medication monitoring for children. We are just in the first, just receiving our first bit of data. This program was to assure that children receiving psychotropic medications are receiving appropriate dosing and appropriate medications.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Hartford. I know you went on to the monitoring of psychotropic medications, but just before that you were talking about the integration model for mental health services. Are there just a few pilots of that, or would you go over that again? Because one of my concerns in the policy area is children's mental health services, which I think are sorely mm-hmm. underserved in the state of Minnesota across the entire continuum. And so, and one of the issues that we hear from the stakeholders is the lack of integrated systems. So I want you to go over that again, that you oversee integrated systems, because I'm not seeing integrated systems. So I'd like to hear what you were saying about that.
Mr. Hartford.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, what I said earlier was it's a huge area for improvement in the system is to continue to work towards integration, specifically addressing the children's system. We are just short on services in almost every area in many different ways. So there continues to be not, I agree with, I believe your point, there is not very good integration. I think that that's accurate and that there is work being done. There is a shortage of services in many different areas. And the local collaboratives, I think they work to try to improve that, but we've got a long way to go. I think there's a lot of improvement that can be made there.
And Mr. Hartford, so how does your division approach that, being able to drive integration? I mean, I've been looking at your funding here, and every single line appears to be grants. And then you say you also monitor how mental health services are integrated into our health care programs through policies and whatnot. How do you push for that integration? How does your entity fit in?
I think through all of the planning that takes place, technical assistance, and also through the grant system of, as we administer these many grants, is identifying, let's say, integration, quality communication that are continue to be included in those and continue to work in the planning with the local mental health authorities to make those improvements.
Okay.
Looking at disclosure and policy.
Okay. We collect and analyze data to determine both individual and system outcomes. Training, and we also provide training to improve cultural and family-oriented expertise. Then in the area of our alcohol and drug abuse division, a little bit about that. In 1973, the legislation was enacted to designate the Minnesota Department of Human Services as the alcohol and drug, that the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division as a single state authority on alcohol and drug abuse. The public policy states that the interests of society are best served by providing persons who are dependent on alcohol and other drugs with a comprehensive range of rehabilitative and social services. The statute establishes and mandates responsibilities for the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division with the overall goal to reduce alcohol use as well as resulting social and economic costs. Recently, Commissioner Jessen and DHS has partnered with nine other state agencies to create a statewide substance abuse strategy. This is really a framework for the future and addresses a really wide range of issues, all the way from, well, what's really at the top of the list, the opiate problem in the state today, prevention, treatment, really the whole spectrum. So now we have 10 agencies working on a joint plan that extends into the future. It's really the first one of its kind in the state that recognizing not only the devastation that substance abuse brings to the health and safety of Minnesotans, but also the fact that it needs that coordination between multiple agencies in order to have impact on these some of these very complex problems.
You know, Mr. Hartford,
yes.
You know, and I think the same integration issues occur around alcohol and drug abuse. And I'm gonna go back to some of what we were talking about with Assistant Commissioner Lights as well, with the HCDS, the healthcare delivery system demonstration projects and whatnot. Have you been active in that and making sure that some of that integration occurs in these demonstration projects? I mean, that's kind of what we were talking about, breaking down barriers, understanding that some of the health barriers that individuals that are frequent flyers at our ERs and in our hospitals are, you know, sometimes it's mental health issues behind, and the lack of integration creates a situation where the system is used in the wrong way to support these individuals through higher level hospital care and stuff. And so, you know, appropriate integration into those HCDS models could be a really good way to approach this. And I'm just wondering if there's been coordination amongst chemical and mental health and the healthcare divisions as we roll some of that out.
Mr. Chair, yes, there's multiple efforts on multiple fronts in order to move this down the road. One of the pieces recently done was we just contracted and established with the University of Minnesota a center for integration to continue education of providers. We're working with healthcare administration around the development of behavioral health homes. Also in the integration within our healthcare home model to incorporate children's mental health, SBIRT, which is screening and a brief intervention and referral to treatment. It's a model that's, again, an evidence-based practice to be delivered by primary care physicians in their clinics. So there's, on multiple fronts, there's many projects going on to try to move this down so that these different areas of healthcare work better together.
Great. I think you're sensing that there's a lot of support for this type of work. If you need help from the legislature, engage us, and we'll try to provide those supports. Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, can we get a big whiteboard in here? And wouldn't that be great to kind of visualize this whole thing, how it should be integrated? I mean, I'm joking, but I'm kind of not.
No,
because it's very complicated with
that's
all
the way,
pieces
that's
that
the
need
way
to
my mind works, too.
A whiteboard.
I mean,
a blank whiteboard. That's how mine works.
We'll work on it. We'll see. You know, maybe some small groups working on it. I don't know if this is the right forum for it, but really trying to break this down. And we'd love to really engage with you and help you bring some of these to life. I mean, I do believe it is the key to real health care reform and the triple aims you'll hear me talking about a lot. That's what we're supposed to be working toward, is better personal experiences and outcomes that, you know, this would yield. Better population-based health and SBIRT and these screening tools can really reach down into people before they've escalated and provide that better population health. And then if we do those two well, the third just follows, which is bending that cost curve and actually really providing care at more competitive costs. And it's what Minnesota's always done. So this is exciting work, and we stand ready to help. So keep us engaged. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and great topic and approach and discussion. I thought a comment that Mr. Hartford made in regards to the CCDS, where we had an experience where we lifted tons of mandates and restrictions for that program, which allowed them to do exactly that. So it makes me wonder sometimes if the, quote, helpfulness of the legislature can be more of allowing, freeing, releasing, and allowing and letting our very able people apply their knowledge and their expertise. I mean, I've heard several times about, and I remember at the time of the CCDS, it was like, oh my gosh, this was, you know, but we've learned so many good things both in the hospitals themselves and their systems, and sometimes the helpfulness is be careful. Mm-hmm. About, you know, we're legislators, and doing that, we have some really, really good folks who know about this. But I think my question would be more, what's in the way? What is it that we in the legislature and some other things and stuff that are getting in your way? Because I think there's good heart, there's desire, there's willingness and need. But sometimes it's kind of a contrary thing. We think of being helpful by doing something or require something else. Sometimes that it may be the most helpful thing is to go the other direction.
Right. I mean, your point is well taken that the CCDS program was rolled out as really just a lump sum. My recollection is something on about 10 cents on the dollar of what it costs to provide care to this population. And certainly with that came very little in the way of regulations. You know, I mean, it's hard to bring people in when you're offering them 10 cents on the dollar. So we just said, well, there it is. I mean, the whole unallotment, I mean, a big thing. I wasn't a big fan of the CCDS rollout, and that needs to be clear. But in that experience, when they had that money, they really did learn some valuable lessons about how to better allocate resources to provide the systems work that we need. And so even when something happens that I don't agree with, I think it's really important as a public policymaker that we bring it back in and take a really good look at what happened and what worked and what didn't work, and truthfully that brought some value to the table, and we're going to look at trying to build that integration, break down those barriers, allow the healthcare system in Minnesota. I mean, healthcare providers came to this work because they want to help people live better lives and healthier lives. I mean, we have a tremendous resource, and if we can free them up to provide those by breaking down the incentives for the fragmented care provided within silos, that's all to the good. And that's what we're pushing for here. So,
Senator Lori?
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I really am appreciating this discussion. I think that as we get moving, one of the things that's unfortunate is the number of people on this committee are not on the policy committee. Mm-hmm. The number of people on the policy committee are not on this committee. So these conversations... But I can assure this committee that this discussion will be part of what I'm hoping will challenge when we have a discussion in the policy committee about what the vision or the direction is for in healthcare, in mental health, chemical health, physical health. How is that going to be integrated? Because that's the policy that comes through the policy committee and then gets funded in this committee. So I look forward to an aggressive discussion about these issues in the policy committee.
And, Mr. Chair, just to
We took you way off your, you know, but it's really something that we all do.
I think some helpful information would be is really all three policy divisions are actively working. The Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division, there's a report due to the legislature in March around the continuum of care. So there's been, I think, five stakeholder groups doing planning and doing preparing that that report. About really challenging what are the gaps in the system today, how can we maybe reconceptualize some things. Likewise, in the adult mental health arena reform, what they're referring to is Mental Health Reform 2020. Again, stakeholder groups really taking a look at the design of a number of different services and gaps, if you will, within the delivery system. And how does that integrate all? And again, the context for all of this work is around ACA, what does the movement of the state, healthcare as a whole, the triple aim, what does it all mean to these three divisions? So all of them are actively working, trying to conceptualize what do we need to do differently moving forward.
Great.
I'll move to just some specifics here on the consolidated fund. So that's our current funding mechanism as the primary funding mechanism for outpatient, residential, and hospital-based treatment. Projected fiscal 14-15 costs are forecasted at approximately $273 million, which is funded by $160 million of state appropriation and the remaining $112 million by a combination of federal and county revenue. Other state funding administered by the division include $2.6 million biennially for two targeted grants for underserved populations. The division is also responsible for the allocation monitoring of substance abuse federal block grant funds. The federal block grant funds.
The consolidated fund is something we talk about frequently, but I don't see it on the sheets that we had presented. We see the chemical dependency entitlement grants, the $161 million looks like state appropriations, but you said that the consolidated fund was that plus $112 from county and federal sources. Is that correct?
Yes.
Million, and that's what the consolidated fund is?
Consolidated fund is...
Maybe you could follow up with the committee with some all funds approaches to what we name things, because it's not, you know, we have a sort of a federal fund breakout, and we don't have anything here on county
and
support
simply
in
the,
our hands out.
The one-page handout,
yep,
that has the state portion. That other pie chart, maybe I confuse things. I wanted you to just see what the distribution of federal contribution to the state was, is really what that green pie chart. That's federal contribution to this area.
Mm-hmm.
So back to the consolidated fund. That 273 is made up of $160 million of state appropriation, and that is made up, it's approximately 22% from the county and block grant of to make that $112 million.
Excuse me.
Yes,
Senator
Sharon.
I'm not sure if
not
I have the information
yet.
That
right.
I don't have that in front of me. What you're referring to, we don't have anything to look at.
Okay.
Is that correct?
Yeah, and we don't have that on the sheets in front of
apparently
us.
Apparently not.
We have the state,
I have to apologize,
and we
for
have
that,
the federal, which only it looks like the total federal funds is 72,000. So I mean, I have 72 million rather. 73.
Let me redistribute. Make sure that you get
so
appropriate documents.
We should follow up with the committee. We'll go ahead and
look with that.
Talk, but we should get a look at the entire consolidated fund. What's state? What's federal? What's county? Just so that we have a good understanding moving forward.
Mr. Chair. The other federal block grant, I just wanted to, because I'm kind of back to what was said earlier about one of the challenges, I think, is let's say the federal dollars come with very specific, the Chemical, Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division manage 140 grants out of that division. And many of them are very specific, and I'll just list off some with the federal grant dollars, one for chronic, chemically, and homeless, criminal justice, American Indian Continuing Care Services, co-occurring services, substance abuse screening with primary care. All of these are kind of directed already. So there's a lot of, in the funding streams that kind of come into the department, are kind of allocated already into specific ways that those dollars should be spent. And it's just the way the systems tend to be built over time. So with that, I'm going to just review very quickly the, and if you don't have it, I'll just list off some of these dollars, the base appropiation.
We do have the state.
You do have the state. Okay.
We do have the state on the flip side,
right.
But it's only the state, and we don't see
the breakdown of the fund.
The consolidated fund in its whole, and the state portion of the consolidated fund isn't labeled as a consolidated fund, and that's something that, as members, we kind of get used to the consolidated fund, and so it was a little confusing. I saw people flipping through. That's what CCDTF is. One of those Cs is consolidated, I believe. Yeah.
I believe it's Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund.
Yeah, there it is.
Right. So again, and I think in closing, I've mentioned a couple of these already about the behavioral health continuum, the mental health reform 2020 groups that continue to plan, and we'll be bringing that forward implications to this committee later yep. in the session.
Great, Senator Claussen.
Yes, thank you. We've been talking a lot about grants. Are these competitive grants?
Mr. Hartford. Senator Claussen, yes, they are. And many of them, maybe two-year, three-year cycles on those grants, and then they're competitive grants for the most part, yes.
In distributing those grants within the state, is that also a competitive process?
Mr. Hartford.
Mr. Chair, please repeat that.
When
Senator
we
Claussen.
Distribute those grants to counties, various entities within the state, is that also a competitive process?
Mr. Hart,
Mr. Chair, Senator Claussen, yes, I believe that is. Yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Claussen? All right.
Mr. Hartford.
Well, thank you for your presentation. I look forward to working with you as we move forward.
Sounds good. Thank you.
DHS's preference, we have the Minnesota Sex Offender Program and state-operated services left to go, whichever state-operated services looks like. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. We have a handout coming.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Ann Berry, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I'm here this morning to provide a brief overview of state-operated services. I'll get into a little more detail about the parts of state-operated services, but I'd also like to remind the committee that the Office of the Legislative Auditor is doing an evaluation audit of state-operated services. You will have lots of information, lots of background information and recommendations from the legislative auditor about state-operated services. They've done a very in-depth review. They're nearing the final stages of production and completion of that report, so I expect probably next month. I don't want to take their thunder away from them,
yes.
But probably next month we will have a lot more, even more information for you to review about state-operated services. So for now, I'd like
Senator
to just...
Lori? Before you
yes.
go, may I ask,
yes.
what is
Commissioner,
the...
Commissioner Barry, the OLA, this is one of their three or four annual really in-depth audits, correct? Not just one of the standard that is done annually.
Mr. Chairman, this is one of their program evaluation audits. It's a very in-depth kind of audit. It will look something like the audit of the the Sex Offender Treatment Program from 2 years ago.
Yeah. Senator Sharon.
Well, I just wondered if you could highlight what the particular emphasis or focus, usually the audit narrows its focus to certain subjects, and unless you do not want to do this at this time, Senator Lori, I'd be curious to know what the special
emphasis
is.
They usually frame it in terms of a question or two or three. Do you have those right off the top of your head?
Mr. Chairman, I can say that there are at least three major questions with sub-questions within those questions. I would say it's a very broad, Mr. Chairman and Senator, it's a very broad look at state-operated services.
We can do that later.
Great. With that.
So, Mr. Chairman and members, what you have in front of you is just a two-page, very brief overview of state-operated services. State-operated services is a division of the Department of Human Services. It reports directly to me in my position as the Deputy Commissioner. That's been a change in governance structure over the course of the last 18 months. There's a number of both residential programs and treatment programs serving people who are mentally ill, chemically dependent, developmentally disabled, and people with traumatic brain injuries. There are just under 200 site-based programs in state-operated services, so we have programs that cover the entire state. I'll do my best to try to paint that picture of the entirety of the system. Our mission in state-operated services, much like the mission of the department, is to work with others, to partner with others, so that we can provide services to people so that they can have their basic needs met, so that they live in dignity and can live in the most integrated kind of environment that they can live in. Who we serve? Let me talk specifically about some of the programs we have. About halfway down this sheet, under the bullets, you can see we lay out some of the specific programs. We have community-based psychiatric hospitals. They're sometimes referred to as community behavioral health hospitals. You'll find a wealth of acronyms in this programs. I'll try not to use them. But community behavioral health programs are really community-based psychiatric hospitals. People who are here need an inpatient level of care for services. It's a step down from other inpatient programs like at Anoka or like at Hennepin County Medical Center or at Regions. This is a more community-based level of care, but still very intensive, and we have a number of them across the state.
And how about the funding for that particular level of services? Are we at all successful in drawing down any federal funds?
Mr. Chairman, there's been quite a history with the community behavioral health program, health hospitals, but I believe we are now drawing down a federal share. They all have been CMS certified or licensed so that they are eligible for people eligible under those programs, and we are drawing federal share. They are still directly appropriated at this time. I don't want to spend too much time on the legislative auditor's report, but one of the things they are looking at are those programs that are directly appropriated in state-operated services, and those that are part of what we call an enterprise fund that live off their own receipts. And there's a lot of confusion. I mean, these programs might be able to live off their own receipts. In fact, they most likely could live off their receipts from the state Medicaid program and the federal match associated with it. But right now, they are directly appropriated programs.
But we are drawing down the federal funds.
We are drawing down federal funds for those programs.
That was a long slog.
That was a probably an eight-year,
yes.
Mr. Chairman. It was about eight, 9 years, and we've reached the point. I think our last certification visit was in Rochester this year, just recently in the last few months.
Excellent.
Next up is the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. It is an inpatient psychiatric hospital. It is a campus-based program. It is one of our few remaining large campus-based programs. In fact, we only have two campus-based programs left in state-operated services. It's located in Anoka. It serves people from across the state. It serves adults are mainly treated in these programs. Next up is the Minnesota Security Hospital. It is located in St. Peter. Here we specialize in forensic services. In a full continuum of forensic services, we have a nursing home on campus. We also serve people who have been committed to us by the courts as mentally ill and dangerous. We also have probably a handful of people who also have developmental disabilities or brain injuries, but they also have been committed by the court as mentally ill and a threat to the public safety. Mostly clients there are mentally ill, and that's the diagnosis they carry. Do you want me to just keep running through that?
Sure.
Okay. Next up is community support services. These are services that are provided in the community. We have a staff of people. We've recently added to that staff. We've doubled that staff so that we can prevent placement when possible. If somebody is living in the community and simply needs a service to wrap around what they're currently getting, or they need consultation or advice, what we try to do is move upstream and prevent a more intense placement, whether it's at St. Peter, whether it's in any of our other programs. We work with people who work in the community to avoid placement when possible. So community support services does what we can to reduce more costly institutional-based services.
And Commissioner Berry, the federal support for community support services, tell me a little bit about that.
Mr. Chairman, for those clients who are eligible for medical assistance, many of these services would be covered, but there's also a direct appropriation that comes to the department to cover the cost of community
support services.
So
this is not one of the enterprise functions either.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
This is a direct appropriated.
This is also a direct appropriation.
And this is like the ACT teams and...
Well, the ACT are, Mr. Chairman, the ACT are mental health teams, and I believe those are funded out of chemical and mental health services. I don't know if Assistant Commissioner Hartford is still here. Many of those are funded out of mental health grants.
Okay.
These teams don't specifically focus on people who are developmentally disabled or physically disabled or people with brain injuries, but that's probably the stronger emphasis. As you are well aware, the department settled a lawsuit against the department, against the what was called the MEDO program. I can't even remember what Extended Treatment Options, Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Program. As part of that settlement agreement, we agreed to add more staff to community support services, and that's how we've gone about doubling that staff. But it is a direct appropriation.
Okay.
Next up, then, are community-based dental clinics. For years when we ran institutional-based programs across the state, each one of the campuses had a dental program. In fact, we had many in-house-based medical services and dental services. Over time, it became clear that people with developmental disabilities and other disabilities were more difficult to serve in community-based or private dental clinics. We began to serve the dental needs then of clients who were both in our care and those in private residential facilities. Just in the last year, we received legislative authorization, I believe it was last session, maybe the session before, to seek federal reimbursement, and I believe did receive federal approval to receive a federal share for these services. These are all Medicaid-eligible clients, and these are freestanding dental clinics, and so I might have somebody from healthcare give us the specifics about how much is coming to the department, but we think we're in a better position today. This was fully appropriated and has been fully appropriated out of the general fund, but as I said, these are clients who are eligible for medical assistance, and we have the authority we need to seek the federal approval. I'm just not sure that we've received it yet. We also provide chemical dependency inpatient and outpatient services in the department. We have a number of programs. They're often referred to as CARE programs. These serve people with chemical dependency issues. We've also begun to develop expertise and capacity around people who really have a dual diagnosis of both chemical dependency and mental health issues. Most often people come to us with dual issues, and often more than just chemical dependency and mental health issues. But we've really tried to build these programs. So based upon the earlier conversation you had about a more integrative way and approach to serving people, these programs really are building up capacity in both of those areas. They are paid rates that are determined by the chemical and mental health services area of the department. So we, like private providers, receive a rate or a payment for the cost of services, and these are considered enterprise programs. They live off their fees. We also have a number of community-based vocational programs, day training and vocational programs for clients who not only reside in the programs where we serve people, but also private clients who live in the community come to some of our day programs and our vocational programs. As you know, the push really is to move more towards supported, more integrated work, more competitive employment. The department is really a very big part of those activities as well that are taking place both, again, on our camp, in our programs, and really in private programs as well. And the last piece, really, I skipped over this, but shouldn't. It's the community residential programs. They're often referred to as MSOCs. They are our state-operated community services. These are four-bed homes scattered throughout the state where people mostly with developmental disabilities live in their communities and are part of their communities and have day programming or supported programming in the community. But there we have many of them, again, across the entire state. The second page then really is an overview of funding, although we've been talking about funding issues along the way here. We have both direct appropriated accounts and we also have enterprise accounts.
Just so you're not confused, Commissioner Berry, we're getting the OLA front page is just being handed to us that actually give us the evaluation issues and four questions. So, I mean, when we'll let you finish your presentation. I think you're getting close, but we'll have that if members have questions about that as well. But like you said, I don't think you want to steal OLA's thunder or anything like that, but this should be delivered probably in February. It was usually when they target those, and we'll see in front of us the actual questions that were posed to the OLA then. So that's great. But continue. I just didn't want you being confused because members are getting handouts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So as we've been talking all along, the state-operated services programs, all of them are funded in basically two ways. One, we receive either a direct appropriation for the operation of our services from the legislature, or we are authorized. The second funding mechanism is we are authorized to create enterprise funds. We then collect the fee and return it back to run the program. So those last two programs, as an example, I talked about, the Minnesota state-operated community services and the day training and rehabilitation programs, those are funded in the enterprise fund. The community behavioral health hospitals, they're currently directly appropriated, but they are now all fee-based. We are eligible to receive federal funds. It's possible that a movement could be made to the enterprise fund, but for now they're directly appropriated. Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center is a direct appropriation from the legislature. Security Hospital in St. Peter is also a direct appropriation from the legislature. Community-based services, community support services, dental services, those are directly appropriated. And finally, chemical dependency inpatient programs and outpatient programs are in the enterprise fund. So I would like to be able to explain in a more simple way that there's a pattern or there's a rhythm or there's a explanation for how something gets in the enterprise funds or doesn't. I think one explanation or the easiest explanation or rule I think that has been applied generally is that if there are fees to support the cost of operating the program, whether it's through medical assistance or private payments, we've tried to place those programs in the enterprise fund, or the legislature has directed us to put them in the enterprise fund. But that rule doesn't hold for all of our programs, as you can see in the explanation I've just provided. Then you can take a look, again, the final is just a simple chart that lays out how much is in enterprise funds, how much is in direct appropriations. And then finally, there are payments that come out of the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund to pay the rates and costs for the chemical dependency treatment programs. But I still shape them or call them enterprise funds because we're operating on the fees that come to the program, and it's not part of a direct appropriation.
Right. Those are out of the consolidated fund. They're not appropriated to support those services. They're fee-for-service payments for the services as they're provided. And members can note, too, there's a number of folks that are the direct line staff that provide these services out in the field in the green shirts in the back here. And if you want to talk to some of them, I know they have a lot of great insights into the nuts and the bolts and the boots on the ground, valuable resource as we move forward as well. Questions on state-operated services for Commissioner Berry? Thank you. And now we do have the project description, so we'll have a little heads up what to look for. But with that, we'll move on to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Thank you, Commissioner Berry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Next up, then, is the Minnesota Sex Offender Treatment Program. Again, a program from a governance perspective that reports directly to me in my position as deputy commissioner inside the agency. There is also plenty of activity taking place around the sex offender treatment program, as many of you are well aware. Maybe as a backdrop, I'll just talk about some of the things that you probably, many of you know about, but just to get us all to the same place. The department was facing about 65 separate lawsuits from clients in the sex offender treatment program. Those cases were all consolidated in federal district court and is now part of a class action suit against the state. We have been working closely with Judge Magistrate Keyes to work on issues that we can settle. You know, where we have the authority, the department has the authority to settle some of these issues. We will work with the court to try to address some of the issues that have been raised by clients, but there are plenty of issues that have been raised by clients that clearly are outside of the authority of the department to make changes. Mr. Chairman, you are fully aware of at least two of the activities that came out of that settlement discussion. One was the creation of the task force, I believe, of which you are a member,
yes.
And others may be members as well, so you might certainly be able to talk more about some of the activities of the task force. They've made their first set of recommendations. And then there was also a settlement agreement that we would create an evaluation team. So there is now a 5-person evaluation team from experts around the country in sex offender treatment. They are observing our program. They are observing the treatment interactions. They are and will yearly evaluate and provide reports to the court on the status of sex offender treatment in the state of Minnesota, offering opinions not only on the breadth of the program, but also in individual cases, the biggest issue being movement from one phase of treatment to the next phase of treatment. So very broadly, the spotlight is clearly on this program in a variety of ways. There was also a legislative auditor's report from 2 years ago that I think still remains extremely instructive, provided really a framework or a pathway for the things that needed to be addressed in this program. Many of those recommendations have been implemented by the department, but we also still need legislative authority if we're going to advance other recommendations of the report. So with that as a backdrop, I'll just quickly...
I'll add to it just a little bit. As I am on that task force, I mean, I think that the federal courts gave us clear direction that they want us to solve any problems that we can before they get to the merits of the class action lawsuit that they are considering right now. And the task force, their first set of recommendations revolved around establishment of some less restrictive alternatives for individuals who are appropriate for a less restrictive alternative, still balancing public safety clearly. That's clearly in the report. But right now, what our system is faced with is an either-or situation. When an individual who is a sex offender is finishing their criminal sentence, we have to decide, do they go behind, you know, concrete and barbed wire, or do they go out to the street? And really, these are not black and white issues, and we need to have a more robust set of options for ensuring public safety and meeting the constitutional guidelines that are very core to our commitment to the rule of law in our country as well. And so we've been working. It is a bipartisan set of legislators. I'm working very diligently with Senator Limmer, is the Republican from the Senate that's on that committee with me. And we've got a very good working relationship and kind of a bit of an understanding how we're framing the conversation and moving forward. And we need to do this together and make sure that we respond appropriately. The alternative really is to cede the point and allow the feds to come in and take over our system. I mean, I think that's the shot across the bow that they've sent, that they're looking very carefully at what we do. We have a chance to put the constitutional underpinnings behind this program and run it in a Minnesota way, or they're probably going to come in and run it for us, you know, or the possibility of striking the law altogether. You know, of course, this has been upheld historically, but again, they are taking Minnesota's challenge very, very seriously. And so we're going to do everything that we can to have a good policy-based discussion that will be a difficult one to get through. But hopefully, if we all put our best foot forward and try to do this together, we can get to a much better place. And that I'll leave it at that for now. We will have many discussions around it as we move forward. And unless folks want to engage further. Commissioner Berry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just let me talk a little bit about the program as it currently exists today. It is a program within the Department of Human Services. It provides services to individuals who have been court-ordered, as you said, to receive sex offender treatment. It is clearly a heavy institutional-based, highly secure treatment facility. We have two campuses. One is in St. Peter and one is in Moose Lake. Generally, I would say those clients who are in the Moose Lake sex offender treatment program are those in their earlier phases of treatment. Those who are on the St. Peter campus are those who have moved through at least two phases of treatment and are nearing really the end of treatment in the facilities. It is a balance that the chairman spoke about that is always in focus for us, that balance of treating people who have been committed to us as sex offenders while ensuring the public's safety at the same time. And sometimes creates a tension, but is clearly an important and essential balance for these programs to operate. Most of our clients come to us from the Department of Corrections. Really, they're at their end of their confinement with the Department of Corrections, and there is a risk assessment that takes place at that point. Once that risk assessment takes place, it's determined whether a person who has been committed in corrections would come to our program in Moose Lake or not. As the chairman said, it's really a yes or no. I just would like to add one point. On January 22nd, there'll be a public notice of a request for information that is being released by the department. We're seeking to understand the capacity that exists to serve people outside of institutional programs. And what we're seeking to find out is the capacity of community private providers, but also, in some case, governmental providers, to provide a highly secured level of treatment in the community. It's one of the task force recommendations that we think we can get in front of by really assembling a group of potential requesters or people who are already providing services in the community to see if there is capacity to really create another option for secure treatment in the community and outside of our two big institutional programs. If the civil court determines – oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. I did carry a bill for MSOP when in the House, so it's a subject that I am familiar with. But one of the things that in the discussions with Sheila Brandt and just some of the others at the time was the waiting until you have your treatment area. And I think the focus is, and I know this is an area that's changed dramatically in the last year, so some of this, it takes a little while to catch up with it. One is sentencing, and the other thing is treatment within the Department of Corrections rather than waiting for them to get out, because many times their experiences in the DOC are contributory. And if we can do some preventative things or take care of them within there, would it possibly help lessen the need of services with MSOP in the in a different kind of a way? So those are kind of the subject areas, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer, your point is absolutely well taken. This is I always refer to it as really a pipeline, and there's so many areas in that pipeline that really need attention. When I try to frame it, you know, I always say I think that we can probably all agree that really the broad goal of a sex offender program is to use our scarce public resources, which is, you know, seated. We have scarce public resources to the best use to reduce the occurrence of sexual violence in our communities. And, you know, if we come at it from that approach, I think we can really have a much more productive conversation about exactly where in the pipeline we can work. I mean, truthfully, I always go way back to the start even and say that we really need kind of a public health approach in some regards, and we can't lose sight of that and have some prevention dollars, you know, to have some awareness of what sexual violence is in our communities as well. I mean, I think that, you know, what we're buying here with the MSOP is for the 600, you know, worst of the worst, we're spending all of our resources that we spend on sexual violence pretty much. And it changes society's perception of what sexual violence is. And so it kind of highlights the need to look at it in terms of a pipeline. So there's prevention. Once a crime is committed, we need to look at sentencing. We did back in 2005 instituted indeterminate sentencing. Truthfully, that hasn't really been used a lot. It is a tool so that individuals could stay within the corrections model. But I think the sentencing guidelines, they didn't come out definitively, but it sounded to me like really it becomes a tool in our overburdened justice system for getting plea bargains. You know, people don't want to go in under an indeterminate sentence, and so they plead guilty and get a determinate sentence where there's an end. We can look at some of that. There's what happens during the corrections time, certainly making meaningful treatment available in prison. I believe the percentage is 10% of sex offenders in the corrections model get treatment while in corrections. We could certainly improve on that and make that meaningful both in terms of progress and in terms of credit at the end of the corrections model. We can look at the referral and commitment process, make sure that they're statewide. I mean, that's another piece that the OLA really highlighted that is of constitutional dimension. The fact that where you committed your crime and where you were sentenced plays a significant role in the level of the percentage of referrals that come from different areas are very disparate. That's a big problem. Statewideness is a uniform application of our laws is a really core function. Once in MSOP, you know, progression through the treatment model with, a real focus on being able to progress and get out. So, I mean, your point, what I took from you is that we really need to look at many points along the way, and I fully agree, and we will have many conversations about that and hope that we can get to a better place and truthfully have that commitment to law and use our scarce public resources to the best of our abilities to reduce the occurrence of sexual violence in our communities. And we have a lot of work to do, and there's many areas to focus on. Senator Hayden.
The one thing I want to add, and I was stepped out of the room for a minute, hopefully Senator Kiffmeyer might have covered it, but there is a lot of folks who are committed that were sexually abused when they were children. And so this idea, and it's a little outside, it's inside of DHS's purview, but a little outside of this conversation. but the idea that we need to protect our children as well, and we need to figure out how do we do that. And so we have a lot of offenders that were victims before they became offenders as well. And so I think we have to kind of get really, really upstream in Children and Family Services and our child welfare divisions to start to figure out how do we protect children. The legislative auditor had a report last year that said that the way in which we define maltreatment and neglect within our system is different in each and every county. And there was no standardized way in which we figured out how to protect our children. And so I know that we have create a pipeline of offenders a lot of times by them being victims when they were children.
Senator Lori.
Senator Sharon.
Thanks. We're in yep. an important conversation here. So, but I just wanted to supplement what Senator Hayden is saying. And this really mm-hmm. isn't, we're talking about the expenditures at the most difficult end of the continuum. You know, can we spend it better in corrections than if we're in a hospital-based system? For those who have already offended, those who are already questionable in terms of the effectiveness of a treatment program where the public safety is known to be a high risk. And then there's this whole population that's out there where they're high risk, but we don't know about them. And then we go down to the children who are the victims who potentially become the next perpetrators. But my interest in the public policy division and in really trying to promote public health programs, and I'm hoping we will have more conversation with all of us about this, is in helping families understand when they're doing to get a perpetrator, you have to go through several generations of steps of boundary violations before you get a perpetrator perpetrating within an intergenerational relationship. You have to have a lot of confusion in sexual development and thinking and boundary development to occur several family generations for that to happen. So we have to go back to talking about how families sexualize their children with their humor, how they do not understand that they're already boundary violating and perpetrating their children through humor, through what they watch on television, through what they place in form of magazines on the tables or under their beds or in their mattresses where their children see it. So things that are not criminal yet, but are a part of the boundary violation that eventually breaks down the boundary system that keeps people from becoming or being victims or perpetrators. So when we get into the policy committee and talk about public health, and the commissioner's already come and talked a bit about that, that's what we're talking about. That's real prevention. When we've got a victim, we're past the prevention stage. We're already into intervening with the consequences. So I'm glad to see people leaning forward on this subject. It's so expensive to be talking about it up at this end, where people have already perpetrated and we're worrying about whether they'll do it again. There's so much. That's like the caboose on a train. And the engine has started way back with family systems, not understanding that they're engaged in boundary violations. I'm very passionate about this and about the protection of children and the Children's Defense Fund. So we'll be talking a lot more with your help, Senator Hayden, in the policy committee.
Senator Kiffmeyer, and then we're probably going to continue with the...
Yeah, it is a...
We could go...
It's a great discussion. I will miss being on the policy committee for that reason. I think that one of the things that I would like with one of the committees or wherever it is, I know that we have a couple programs in my county that have proven records of success in this particular area, and especially touching on some of those things, that I was wondering if there would be any time at all in our committees to, you know, with the help of the department or members or so on, to hear from some of the local folks who have maybe had some programs that are successful in that regard. I know when I was on the hospital board, we had Rivers of Hope in our area talk about this area, and this was like 15, 16, 17 years ago. I thought it was quite progressive, and it dealt with recognizing those things, and then they had a program to help determine once they kind of realized which vulnerable person, this was early intervention, was in the situation. It almost kind of reminds me of the chemical dependency in the early days before they knew about like some of the family codependency things where they only just treated the alcoholic or even prior to that just put him in the prison thing. And some of the similar kind of dynamics going on. But I'm just wondering, Mr. Chairman or Madam Chairman, if there might be some opportunities for, I'd like to know what's working before we start throwing stuff at it.
Senator Lurie.
Yeah, Senator Sharon.
I appreciate that. I think your term there, called the codependency term, really is a term that relates to why systems enabling acting out. It's a common term in chemical dependency. Systems that enable smoking have been, we've been breaking that. Systems that are enabling chemical abuse. That's where the real intervention can occur, is that we do not support systems that enable boundary violations in family systems that make children victims of sexual perpetration. And instead of trying to spend so much money, I mean, we've got this new system of children who are sexually exploited, who are put into the criminal justice system as though they're criminals of committing crimes of prostitution, when they are, in fact, sexual slaves and have over a series of time had boundary violations occur, so they don't even know that they have the right to assert themselves and protect themselves. So absolutely, breaking up the systems that enable this is where we need to direct a lot of our resources. And right now, the percentage of money spent there in prevention of this and other programs as compared to the size we spend in trying to clean up the mess requires us as a state to have this conversation and to look at what works and to try to start to implement it.
And to respond to Senator Kiffmeyer's question, you know, the task force has been meeting for, I don't know, a couple of months, and there's many treatment providers. I think some of the ones from your community are on the task force, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not certain of that, but I think that to be the case. If not, we're open to, you know, public comments as well on that task force. So we've had a pretty good conversation about what's available, what works, how we structure it, and we've got some recommendations out of that task force. In terms of timing for the committees, what I see coming forward is I see a bill introduction in the not-too-distant future. You know, we're kind of working on the pieces of that, putting it together. This is, none of it should be, you know, terribly surprising. I mean, Senator Limmer and Representative Cornish in the last biennium worked on a bill. They dropped it for a little while, pulled it back. It's pretty much public. There's some pieces in there that are valuable, some that are, you know, in my opinion, didn't work quite to the way they should have, but a lot of good work in there. There's also a piece that former Chair Berglund and Senator Hahn and I had worked on in response to the OLA report. That's a public document. A lot of those components still deserve a lot of attention and work. So, I mean, those components have been kicked around a little bit. I see a bill, you know, coming together again soon, and when we have testimony on that bill would be a good time for some of the treatment providers to have the opportunity to come up and explain how it would affect them, how they work in the framework that is being defined, how they think it should be modified. You know, give us that thought as we go through the legislative process. So, I mean, I don't think at this stage of the game we're going to have time to do a whole lot of broader legislature. But the task force has all been public, and a lot of the comments are there. You can dig in there and see what the treatment providers and the judges and the county sheriffs and the, you know, law enforcement community and the legislators have said. It's we're working towards this, and so just in response to your question, I think that's what we can expect at the committee table in the coming weeks and months. Commissioner Berry.
Mr. Chairman, I can just finish up with the funding, but I'd like to actually thank you and the committee for making my job very easy here today. And also, as if you would indulge a personal aside, as a former commissioner of health, whenever we talk about primary prevention, I'm thrilled. I think we do know a lot about the very expensive caboose that drives costs in our states, and when we can move upstream, there are many things that we can do to prevent sort of the deep end costs of services. So I'm thrilled by the conversation. Let me just talk about some history in the program, the growth in clients, and then the costs associated with that growth so you can see what those trends look like, what those costs look like in these programs. The number of clients served in this program has grown from 483 at the end of state fiscal year 2008 At the end of state fiscal year 2012, which ended, we are at 653 clients. If we look at that rate of growth and project it out over the course of the next biennium, you can see by the end of June 30th of 2015, we would have a census of 826 clients in our program. The amount that you see of funding of $73 million in both 2014 and then 15 in the next biennium in each year is really just is the base amount. Any increases in that base would have to be part of the governor's budget. And so you would see that.
This is not a forecasted program?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. This is not a forecasted program. So we only put in or are only authorized to put in the base amount, and then any additional dollars for increase in growth in clients would have to be part of a change request from the department and would make its way through the governor's office. I did miss one thing on the last page, and it is really a pivotal point for the department. We did provisionally discharge the courts, the SCAP, which is the Supreme Court Appeal Panel, authorize the provisional discharge of a client into the community. He is he has moved now to a second facility. He did very well in his first placement, his first provisional discharge. Each time there's been a community notification meeting, and the first meeting gathered much attention. The second community meeting did not garner as much attention, there will continue to be the Supreme Court Appeal Panel hearings from clients over the course of the next year, and you will certainly be notified of those as they make their way through the judicial system for those who are ready for provisional discharge into the community. So I guess the important point there just is to see this growth pattern, to see what we're facing. This is a direct appropriation to the department. There is a county share. That county share was increased 2 years ago. It is now a quarter of the cost. Some of that is a reflection, I believe, in legislative discussion that took place at the time, that counties do have some discretion in who gets placed, and those patterns across the state are very different across 87 different counties. And so as a way to reflect those costs or provide any, shall we say, disincentives to placement, the county does have a pretty substantial share in the cost of care here for those clients that are in their counties. But otherwise, this is a direct appropriation to the county, to the state, with a portion funded by the counties.
Great. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I have a question on the numbers here. The fiscal year appropriations then so far are not showing that 25% additional funds?
Commissioner Barry.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Kiffmeyer, that's correct. They would need to be in the governor's budget, which has not been released yet. So any increases in costs would need to be reflected. We're not treated like a correctional forecasted program. We have to carry the cost of increases in our budgets.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Berry, what I was meaning is the county contribution or their portion of that. So in these fiscal year appropriations, that is strictly funds that come from the state general fund and those appropriations. Is there a chart somewhere that includes or would show, the all funds idea?
Commissioner Barry.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, I misunderstood your question. Yes, we can get you the additional county costs associated with the program and break out what is the direct appropriation and what is the cost of the county share. Okay. And I think we should be able to do that on a county-by-county basis.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, thank you. And that wraps up our DHS budget overview. Tomorrow, we will be in this room again. I gave members a little primer about the confusion between 107 and 123. We're duly booked in this room. Early in the session, while finance is not typically meeting, we will try to meet in this room. But on the calendar, we reserved 107 to make sure that we don't find ourselves homeless when finance does meet. So we'll try to use this room whenever possible. Any confusion that occurs, check both rooms. We'll be in one of the places. And just as a heads up for tomorrow, we're going to continue with agency overviews. We're going to focus on Minnesota Department of Health and the health-related boards tomorrow. So this is the end of DHS, and thank you for your participation. We stand adjourned.